Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Pete Quiñones back on the show. Of course, Pete is the host of his own show for the past, I guess, come up on almost 6 years now, the Pete Quiñones Show. He is also the producer and writer of the documentary, The Monopoly of Violence. Monopoly on Violence. His work also can be followed at his Substack page. I'll provide a link, right? That's just Substack page of Pete Quiñones.
Yeah, it's I bought PeteSubstack.com. So, okay. That makes it easier. Yeah.
So that's the okay. So PeteSubstack.com. Well, okay. Well, tonight I have you on. You had a short little piece that you sent out regarding individualism or individual rights, if you say, or are they natural rights? And I sent you the link to the interview with Tucker Carlson. I think it was on Adam Carolla's podcast, where he dismissed the idea of white identity politics and this whole notion of individual rights or individualism. It has particularly has resonance with America. America has always had this myth of individualism, right? That dates, with the founding myths of the country. You had also what James Fenimore Cooper's, Last of the Mohicans, is kind of about that, the individual American who won't play by the rules. And because that book takes place, I think, during the French and Indian War, just before the American Revolution. And so we had this myth of rugged individualism, not completely an erroneous idea in many respects, because individuals do have rights, but often this has, particularly now, because people now, particularly when it comes to ethnic white Americans, sort of the core American ethnic group, Heritage America, we're told that there's no such thing as sort of white identity or white interest. That itself is sort of a deracination or a reduced identity, because white Americans are sort of European Americans. So there was a time you were German American, Italian American, Irish American, and a lot of crossbreeding being those ethnic groups, and they became sort of white Americans. There's the theory of the triple melting pot, where it's basically the ethnic division of America is Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish. It's more diverse now, but the hidden grammar to American history is sort of ethnic warfare, ethnic conflict between those three groups. But nevertheless, in the 20th century, sort of homogenization occurred, Americanization occurred, the melting pot theory. This was done for sort of sociological, also geopolitical reasons, perhaps we can get into. But we're seeing now the weakness of the idea of individualism, because individualism ultimately leads to atomization. And perhaps it's a trick that's played on white Americans not to organize or to collectivize or to organize any resistance to this sort of oligarchic plan to erase the country through mass migration and also psychological warfare, critical race theory, these things being pushed, and a lot of other nonsense that's being pushed now by the powers that be, by the government, by media, by corporations. We can talk some instances of this, but I've rambled on, so I'll let you kick in there. Individualism, is it a valid concept?
I think it's a valid concept within a polity. And I think it's, if somebody wants to invoke their individual rights, I see that all the time coming out of libertarianism. It was something that you were always talking about, your individual rights, my natural rights. Well, in today's world, and in pretty much any world, it's impossible to defend those if you're just an individual. I think a lot of people have the fantasy of, being out on their ranch and, the hordes come and they're just up on their roof with a 308 and they're just picking people off.
Yes.
And that really doesn't work. You need a collective to protect rights. And I think this country started out that way. And I think the founders clearly understood that what they were building was for Protestant, religious, white men and women, but predominantly men, and landowners. And when it comes to individual rights, which, you know, comes out of the, I mean, it comes before the Enlightenment. Let's be honest. You can go back to the Magna Carta. There are plenty of places you can go back beyond the Enlightenment, but the Enlightenment is really where it starts fleshing out. It really starts to spread in the West. And the founding I see as being based upon that. I think the founding documents are based upon individual rights, but also a collective. The Declaration of Independence wasn't one person declaring independence from another. It was a group declaring independence from a group. But they still had an individualistic attitude about them, but they knew that, you know, like the propaganda from the Revolutionary War, join or die. You know, you had the snake in 13 different parts, and it mm-hmm. needed to come together.
Yeah, and we either hang separately or hang together or hang separately, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that really has to be, when people talk about their individual rights, you know, well, how are they going to be protected? That's a really important question to ask and needs to be answered. But if the people who put this experiment together, you know, wanted to see it keep going, well, I think it was for, you know, very religious white men. And once they kind of screwed up right from the start, because even long before that, they had imported onto the land people who weren't white men. And, you know, the question was always going to be, what do we do with these people? You know, what do we do with these people? Well, they were slaves, but a lot of them were free too. You know, people forget that the very first trial of a slave trying to get his freedom, the gentleman, this was in Virginia, his slave owner was black. You sort of had a problem with a mixed culture, a multicultural, multiculturalism from the start. But as time went on and more people just poured over the borders, it just, you know, and then it started before 1960, you know, 1965. But, you know, after that, it was just, you know, it was pretty much all over. Now the country is a mixed mash of cultures. And, you know, you have to remember too that during World War II, you know, the Allies, funded and basically inspired by a lot of Jewish groups, declared war on white Europe, you know, on white Europe. And after the war, the Allies won. And after the war, they decided that they were going to punish Germany for it. And they did. And they had the Nuremberg trials. And as Thomas 777 says, now we've been living under the Nuremberg regime ever since, where right wing, being right wing, is criminal. I'm saying illegal, although it is in some cases, but it's criminal. But it's especially criminal if you're white and right wing, if you're a Christian and you're right wing, if you have a family and you're right wing, and according to the authoritarian personality, if you believe that people who hurt children should be punished further than, you know, more than the law allows, then you have the potential for fascism. So individual rights, as far as I'm concerned, went out the window with Lincoln. He basically said a bunch of people couldn't get together and decide to leave, but they were completely wiped out and stamped out soon after World War II.
Yes, and I mean, there is the concept of individual rights, but you have what would be a sort of an apparent or superficial contradiction, but it really isn't if you apply some thought to it, and more importantly, if you apply it to reality, meaning that first of all, human beings they are social and political beings. Aristotle commented on that. And one advantage that human beings have over the animals is one thing is their intelligence and opposable thumbs and things like that, but their ability to organize and collectivize to defend themselves. And that requires collective action. That doesn't mean that the individual is erased. He's just the individual's rights and his ability to live is defended or vindicated by forming a collective, a community, a village, just a city state, a nation, if you will. So these things aren't necessarily contradictory. It's just only maybe probably in intellectual fever swamp of libertarianism, these things are contradictory. But the reality is that we must have these collective bodies that are organized. We form a caucus, we have a convention, and the origins of those words imply collective action, coming together. And no, we wouldn't say just because there was the constitutional convention where people came together, and the preamble to the Constitution was "We the people," that didn't mean they didn't believe in some level of individual rights, but also believe in collective responsibility. That's the basis of the community. And so, yeah, it is. It's one of these things where it's pushed because individualism can be pushed so far as where it atomizes. It creates an atomized society. And what's interesting is that by the same time that individual rights are being almost fetishized, you have a growth of a sort of a personal liberty. These things, right? Particularly in matters sexual, right? And I think was it Huxley who observed that sexual liberation tends to increase along with political tyranny, something to that effect. So these things are allowed, but basically, to the extent that the individual abandons personal discipline, it has to be made up for in public discipline or public order or more authoritarian systems. And we see it sort of with the chaotic situations where social chaos is promoted in the guise of libertinism or liberty. It creates social chaos, and then you need a police state. And now we don't even have that in many cases. Now you just have chaos, like in places like Chicago, many of the urban areas where those in power seem to be allowing chaos to explode. So yeah, it's one of these things. Again, there's a balancing act here that you have to maintain in order to maintain a civil order. But something like is libertarianism, is it a trick, or is it just an intellectual error?
Well, it really depends. I mean, there are things in libertarianism that libertarians talk about that I think are extremely valid: private property, political decentralization. The only issue is that those aren't exclusive to libertarianism. So you don't really have to add the baggage that the libertarian name brings along with it, like, drug use and prostitution and game. And, we were the first, before anyone was talking about gay marriage, we were the first endorsing gay marriage. It's like, well, calm down. Shh, maybe don't say that out loud.
There are individual rights that you have. I believe that if you are a good person, you should have a gun. I don't want like Antifa to have guns. That's something that libertarians have told me recently is basically a heresy, is that everybody has a right to own a gun. And I'm like, well, then I just can't be a libertarian if you think that my enemy should have a gun. And I understand that I don't have the power to do anything about that because my friends are not in power right now. But, theoretically, and that's all libertarians want to talk about is theory, because their stuff cannot exist in the real world. Theoretically, I wouldn't have my enemies own guns. They would be they would be hobbled when it came to certain rights. But as far as, you know, law abiding, sane, you know, people who, you know, like Evola said, anyone who's, you know, thinks that the principles of a well-born man before the French Revolution are, you know, they adhere to those, sure, they should have a gun, but you also, you know, who's going to defend your right to have a gun? You know, because groups can rise up that will say, no, you can't. And you need to be able to, those individual rights that you have. And, you know, I'm still very partial to negative rights. You don't have a right to take away my gun. You don't have a right to hit me. You don't have a right to kill me. You don't have a right to steal my stuff. I mean, if I have a right for that, somebody shouldn't be able to steal my stuff, I need to be able to be able to defend that right. But the problem is that I can only do so much against the crowd. And that is what we're dealing with. While you have people running around in this culture talking about their individual rights, and, you know, you have the enemy is coming together in groups and they're planning, while you have people running around saying we need to be radical individuals, radical individualists. Well, you have radical people who are collectivizing and taking power and basically doing as they please. And as they please goes against nature. In, you know, the ways that I look at it. So, I mean, resting upon individualism it's logical. It makes sense, especially the way the country was founded, but it's not the same country. And we are surrounded by, you know, for lack of a better term, monsters, demons, who would like to do the individual harm. And really the best way to protect yourself and to protect your quote-unquote rights is to collectivize and figure out a way to protect each other's rights.
Well, yeah, you have these monsters often promoting the notion of individual rights as a way to sort of play to the vanities and weaknesses of the public to eventually enslave them. You know, like, good example is promoting sexual liberation or feminism, these things. That's sort of a radical individualism, although it's a critical theory and it's Marxist in many ways, but consumerism and these things, that's often individualism is promoted in that. That goes back to like Edward Bernays and, you know, or Nike, was Just Do It. The notion of the individual, you know, you deserve it, and these things, you deserve a new car or something, promoting consumerism. At the same time, consumerism is also facilitated through easy credit and debt, which enslaves you. And at the same time, you're being beguiled by the entertainment and the consumerism. They're denying you the ability to think critically. You're being indoctrinated or propagandized, and that's, of course, propaganda. That was, you know, Edward Bernays's book. And, you know, there's like Walter Lippmann, who in Public Opinion admitted that because of democracy, mass democracy, is that the public had to be manipulated in order to be governed and controlled. Meaning that at the same time that mass society. The individual isn't being allowed to think critically or be given the information, the education that they may need to be able to function properly. And the reality is, the vast majority of people aren't political philosophers or moral philosophers. They go day to day by habit, and morality to them is a matter of convention and habit and environment. And so they're very easily manipulated. And the manipulators have written a lot of books about it and studied and scientifically how to do that in a democracy. And while democracy gives a lot of lip service to individual rights, something like voting, at the same time, it works those in control of the democracy, which is an oligarchy, which Aldous Huxley said presumably will always exist, is going to manipulate. Is they're going to be in a condition of control of information. Good example is you know, talk about they'll say that truth is relative, right? There's no objective truth, and we all have our own truth. And the reality is that the vast majority of people don't have the influence or the power to impose their truth, where a few oligarchs do control the mass media or entertainment or corporations. So someone like a Bill Gates, you know, a multi-billionaire oligarch, will be in a position to impose his version of the truth much more effectively than, say, you and I will. And so the idea of imposing a notion of subjectivism or subjective truth or moral relativism doesn't create a situation of moral anarchy. It actually creates a situation of tyranny, because truth becomes the opinion of the powerful at that point. And you and I, in a system that acknowledges objective truth, can have the ability to go to anyone, no matter how wealthy, and go, no, that's wrong. 2 + 2 = 4. Or no, that's morally wrong. You can't do that. But the tyranny they're creating is that they're in a position, because they have so much control of the media and means of communication, to impose their version of the truth. So it's not like there's a democratic system out there where we all have our own idea of the truth, that we're all little kings running around. We're all little sovereigns. Someone's going to be sovereign and impose that order. And that's where we kind of what they've done with by spreading moral anarchy and getting rid idea of objective truth. And now to the point where something as basic as male and female, you know, apparently that is there. They can change that now. Right. And you're on the outs if you stand up for objective truth or even reality, because that goes against the dictates, the sort of the you know, the doctrines that are now being promoted by the regime for whatever reason, you know.
Well, and this is where liberalism shows its greatest failure, doesn't it? Everything you just said is permissible because live and let live, because we have a marketplace of ideas and the best ideas will win out. I actually had somebody tell me recently that the reason why we see this transgender insanity, or as Scott Howard calls it, the transgender industrial complex, why we have all of this and why it's so much in our faces, because you know it won in the culture wars. It won in the marketplace of ideas. And I tried to explain to this person that it absolutely didn't, that it was promoted by social engineers, it was promoted by those in charge, it was promoted by you know, oligarchs for one reason or another, whatever that reason may be, but it was not something that was natural. And as we look at all these things, as we look at the fact that the elites can come up with their own narrative and push it, and it's halfway around the world before we even have a chance to examine it, it's because we're based on liberalism. There was I had Paul Gottfried on recently, and you know, James Lindsay, who is a liberal, was saying that that wokeism is completely Marxist, and Dr. Godfrey does not agree with that. He believes that it's the failure of liberalism, and I'm somewhere in between. I think that there was inspiration from Marx, but I also believe that none of this would have taken hold if this society wasn't based off of a liberal live and let live, quote unquote, phony marketplace of ideas, where social engineers can come in and do whatever they want, where Bernays said in his 1947 essay, The Engineering of Consent, that free speech was absolutely the greatest tool that a social engineer had at his disposal. It allowed it allowed him and his ilk to shape the opinions and the minds of everyone out there. Now, I mean, I'm not saying that free speech is, we need to take away free speech. From my enemies, I'm But liberal, when everything that you mentioned there, everything that they can do, everything, the way they can sway this culture and just make it so that if you speak out and you say, wait a minute, I think this transgender thing might be hurting people, they invoke the term genocide is quickly invoked. And it's invoked because they've been told that's what's, by social engineers, that's what's happening. You know, and then you have the implication of the fact that anytime the term genocide is thought of, immediately you think of the National Socialists, and the National Socialists committed a quote unquote genocide, and they were hung for it. So anybody who is denying trans people exist, they're denying that they should have rights, they're denying that they're special. These people are no better than Nazis. And since they are basically acting as the Nazis did in the 1930s and 1940s, it's okay to, they've gone beyond punch a Nazi to, it's okay to kill Nazis. And apparently, you know, three children under the age of 10 and three teachers in their 60s in a Christian school, those are Nazis. Or they are a substitute for Nazis in some way, shape, or form. But the idea that, you know, this whole, when you, it's hard to talk about individual rights without talking about liberalism, because that's where the idea came from. And, you know, I'm talking about the classical version of liberalism, not the obvious perversions, you know. So Bill Clinton is a liberal, Hillary Clinton is a liberal, that kind of crap, and neoliberalism. I'm talking about the classic version of liberalism that many would say founded this country. Well, it wasn't a real good gatekeeper to keep out bad elements, to keep out bad teachings, to keep out bad doctrine.
Well, it denies the necessity of a gate.
Yeah, there's no,
because the best ideas always win, right? So
it's the best ideas always win, and you know, and
that's why everyone had Betamax over VHS.
And democracy is obviously the greatest form of government. Although I've asked several people recently to define it, and they can't. People who are promoting openly democracy, saying that people are seeking to subvert democracy in the United States. I'm like, okay, so what is democracy? And I think a lot of people listening to this know that democracy is just basically whatever the progressive people in charge, it's their worldview at the moment. That's basically...
Yeah, they think just by some sort of incantation or phrase, they can will it into existence, and it exists. It's like magic. And it's not, the situation isn't quite that simple. You mentioned something like a liberal order preaching individualism denies the reality that an organized cadre or a small group, a malevolent group, which has a very strong sense of identity, can infiltrate that liberal system and take it over in a generation or two, effectively. That's the situation we have in the West. You're right in the article you wrote, I think, yeah, it is empirically true that the masses cannot organize as well as a small cadre of people who have a vision and are willing to act upon it. The fact that society was established upon live ethos, individualism, and volunteerism, allows said cadre to conspire and plan, as would be against the morality of the community, or to preemptively put an end to their scheme. There was a time in the West, before the age of liberalism, the Anxin regime, if you will, you had, confessional states, integral states that were, they were Christian. And anyone who wasn't Christian was outside the community and therefore faced restriction to that community, because they didn't play by the same rules or share the same worldview or perhaps cosmology. And so it was wise to keep them out, or at least to restrict them, not to deny them rights, but to restrict their access to privileged positions within that community, particularly leadership be it social, economic, or political. And there was a sort of a wise recognition of reality. But liberalism gave us this myth that you could present this a set of ideas, a creed, if you will, and put it on paper. Everyone just promises to believe in that creed, they would face no such restriction. And this is what we had in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars in Europe in the 19th century. And those restrictions were removed for the Jews in Europe, who were considered sort of an alien outside group, because there was a time when Europe was synonymous with Christianity. There was a time when it was synonymous with Catholicism, and the faith was Europe, and Europe was the faith, as someone once said. But then it was splintered for various reasons. And but with the French Revolution and liberalism, society opened up and became very vulnerable to this to these groups. And that's something that liberalism is very vulnerable to infiltration. And they can use the language of liberalism to prevent any meaningful opposition or recognition of their malevolence. At the same time, they'll infiltrate society and take over the commanding heights, cultural, political, economical. That's sort of the situation we now face in the West. At the same time, they're the most illiberal group out there because they'll shut down free speech. Good example, with the First Amendment, theoretically, we all have the right to free speech and free press, but that only effectively, you only really have the First Amendment if you're wealthy enough to own a newspaper or a radio station or a network, right? Where very few people own that, and the group that dominates those areas tend to be, a Jewish elite who are going to use those positions to promote their interest and their worldview, which we see. And so effectively, but at the same time, when you have something, a leveling phenomenon like the internet and social media, YouTube, the internet, where the gates were knocked down, the gatekeepers went away, and individuals could actually participate and speak in a way that had sort of a, collectively, it was on par with the mainstream media. They immediately work to shut it down. And all of a sudden, this becomes hate speech, and no longer the First Amendment doesn't apply anymore to these things. And so they invoke terms like hate speech. The ADL came up with that term to suppress speech they don't like. And so all of a sudden, liberalism doesn't even play by its own rules when it's challenged by those playing within the rules. They're just presenting arguments or pointing out, uncomfortable facts that then those in power they can't contend with, so they shut it down. And that's something that we've seen the past 6-7 years. They lost control of the narrative, so that you just, you're deplatformed,
Well, it's hard to tell exactly what the reaction was. Trump definitely changed the game. Things were not good before Trump. We had, I think a lot of it started with Trayvon Martin, then went up to Michael Brown in St. Louis. Black Lives Matter becomes a thing. And the borders are wide open, people crossing over. But even the whole crime issue and the whole Black Lives Matter and the whole Trump, that wasn't something that Trump, Trump spent 4 years pandering to black groups. He was pardoning rappers when he should have been pardoning, Assange or Edward Snowden. He's just like a typical boomer. And and then I really have such a hard time with people who still defend him like vehemently, and they're especially people who will talk about Jewish influence and power, considering he's probably the most pro-Jewish president that ever was. But when you look at basically what happened in the last 7 years, you want to say it was a reaction to Trump. And you want to say, Trump empowered some people to start saying things that they were scared to say before. So They needed to clamp, you know, so they overreacted in the other direction. And, you know, now they're cracking down on every, you know, everyone out there who mentions, you know, that they're white, that they, how come I can't be proud of who I, you know, the color of my skin and my heritage when Black people can do it. I think those people forget about the 90s and how the crackdowns on militia groups in the 90s. I mean, this is not something new. It just 9/11 put it on the back burner because, you know, now we had a new group to be, you know, to concentrate our hate on. They had a new group to concentrate their hate on, but, you know, you sent me the thing about Tucker Carlson and basically Tucker Carlson saying that the, you know, he talks about the Great Replacement and, you know, he's one of the only people, you know, he's the only person in the media, quote unquote, MSM media, who talks about it. And he, you know, he basically says, how do we stop the Great Replacement? And it's happening. He basically says that white politics, white centered politics, politics centered around white interest is pretty much inevitable. But then he just goes off on the typical liberal, some call it the boomer truth regime, you know, the Nuremberg regime. And he says, you know, I just want to go say on the record that I'm going to tell anyone who comes to me talking about, you know, white identity and white politics, I'm going to tell them to F off because nobody speaks. I'm an adult man and nobody speaks for me because he shares the same skin color as me. I just reject the idea, the entire idea. If I agree with you, I'll let you speak for me. If I don't, I won't. But this idea that someone of a certain skin color, any ethnic background, speaks automatically on behalf of all people who share that skin color or ethnic background is a Nazi idea, and I'm totally opposed to it. Well, not leaving aside that this, you know, this is a straw man, and that basically anyone who is talking about white identity is probably not including, you know, the progressive white women who are, you know, who have totally gone along with so much of this and made it happen. I said at the beginning, I said a month into COVID that this basically white women were making this happen. They were celebrating it. And they were, you know, this was something of a crusade, for lack of a better term, for them. But, you know, this is basically Tucker. You know, I mean, I guess a lot of people want to attack Tucker for this and everything and say, well, he's definitely not our guy and everything. Well, I mean, I don't think somebody who comes from the background that he does is our guy. I mean, his dad ran, you know, basically, what was that? Radio America, basically the military's radio station, which is just a propaganda outfit or anything. So, I mean, I don't 100% trust the guy at all. But I don't think there's anything malicious in him saying this. I think that this is just the same thing that, you know, most people's uncle or grandfather or father would say. Because
it's very 20th century.
Yeah. It's just, this is the way that it's been since, especially since World War II, since the Great War, since the Good War. You know, this was the Good War. We went over there and, you know, we fought the Japs and beat the Japs. And, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, most of the men who came back from fighting the Japs were, you know, were happy to do it. And a lot of the men who went to Europe to fight people who looked like them, they came back and it bothered them.
Yeah, there was obviously the word Japan, there's a much more of a racial component to it.
Yeah.
Whereas there was a book by that called it a race war, whereas in Europe it wasn't the same thing, because the ethnic genetic similarities between some of the Americans and Europeans. Obviously, they're you know, you're going back and waging war in your ancestral homelands. You know, your cousins, you know, and your and so it bothered a lot. And also the destruction that was wrought. I mean, you're hollowing out the cradle of Western civilization, these cities, and you know, that were 1,000 years old. You know, in itself was a mass form of iconoclasm that was orchestrated by the Masonic American government against Christian Europe, and that, you can look at it that way. But he invokes Nazis, so he's, you know, that's the same thing. Any expression of ethnic identity, particularly white ethnic identity, is Nazi, especially when applied to America. He kind of ignores the fact that sort of ethnogenesis occurred in the United States, that there was a defined sort of idea of the American that took form in the 19th and 20th century, that was targeted specifically in 1965, you know, with the immigration laws, with the Hart-Celler Act. Interesting enough, they promised that when they signed that law, that wouldn't change the racial balance in the country, the demographics. Interesting that they had to make that promise, that people back then were aware that it did present a problem if you change the demographics of the country. And the fact that they tried so hard and succeeded in changing the demographics of the country means that it matters. If it doesn't matter, then why make the effort? And it is interesting that it was, I think it was in the Eisenhower administration, when he had a commission on immigration that was overwhelmingly Jewish, they came to the conclusion that demography didn't matter, so let's change it. That's an interesting argument. And you had, I think it was the B'nai B'rith who hired John F. Kennedy, put his name on the book A Nation of Immigrants to create that myth. And this was sort of the Emma Lazarus myth and these things. But yeah, it's the idea, again, the idea that any expression of ethnic identity, white ethnic identity, is somehow not legitimate, is something that's Tucker's expressing a very liberal idea there. And it's liberal ideas that only seem to really be supported by white ethnics. Right? I mean, that's the thing, is if you do the polling on things like the First Amendment, Bill of Rights, the Constitution, these things are only broadly supported by white Americans. It doesn't get much support among brown or black Americans or newcomers to the country. They don't have any appreciation for it. So when it comes down to it, the idea of American as a creedal nation is pretty much an ethno state. It's those groups that respect these ideas. It's in our tradition. It's our heritage. And these things do matter. It's not just you can just, you know, that's the magic dirt theory. You come to America and all of a sudden you're an American. Well, that's ridiculous. And we're seeing that play out today. Non-whites assume more positions, assume positions of power, and you know, like whether it's district attorneys and these things, or attorney generals and these things, they have very real regard for the procedure, for rule of law and the Bill of Rights, and the corruption just becomes more obvious every day. And they openly express contempt, you know, for the sort of the rules and the Bill of Rights and the political traditions of the country. All polling shows that. So at the end of the day, your ideas, American as a again, it's an idea. Only a certain ethnic group seems to like that idea. So what have you? So,
well, to go back to, you're talking about white Americans and they're, you know, the ones who are for free speech, ones for the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
By living by that being their credo and their motto, and their enemy is not caring anything about that, they're basically they're destroying themselves. Because if you believe in free speech, and you know, I've heard people say, you know the old phrase, I don't agree with you, but I think you're wrong, but I'll fight till the death. You're basically, unless your enemy lives by the same credo, you're destroying yourself. And people can get mad at me all they want, but white people are basically destroying themselves in this country by holding on to an ethic that the enemy doesn't hold on to. And that ethic is basically still live and let live, still free speech. I mean, I know how many people I know that were like, yeah, gun rights are universal rights. Everyone should be, anyone who is legally allowed to own a gun should have a gun. And I know people who are go beyond that and say that everyone should have a gun. You know, it's that I don't care if somebody is out on parole. You know, if it's safe enough for them to be out of prison, it's safe enough for them to carry a gun. I've heard this boomer crap my whole life. And that's, I mean, that's basically what it is. It's just.
And well, is it the failure to recognize that there's such thing as enemies?
Well,
a little naive, don't you think?
Well, it's very naive. It's these are people. These are people who don't. If you told them, you know, if you mentioned the term social engineer to them, they'd look at you cross-eyed because they have no idea. They wouldn't know what to do. Their eyes would cross.
Yeah. That was interesting. I was reading E. Michael Jones's book on John Connor Crowell on the Cultural Revolution, and he was the Archbishop of the diocese in Philadelphia. And it exposed the social engineering that destroyed the Most Blessed Sacrament parish, which is the source of the most I think it's a huge Irish Catholic diocese or parish, and it was a source of priests and nuns and they had a huge high school and grade school, and it affected the politics of the state. It's a very conservative break on the politics of the state. One thing, particularly matters of birth control, but it was systematically destroyed through social engineering, and he exposes this in the book. One was the civil rights movement, which was a revolutionary movement, a subversive movement in reality, and how integration was used to break up the Irish neighborhood and send them into the suburbs. And he did all his research, and he presented the evidence to John Cardinal Kroll, and John Cardinal Kroll's response was, we can't tell people where to live. A very liberal response, right?
Right.
But it rejected, he was completely ignorant, or he failed to consider all the social engineering and thereby coercion that was used to achieve that and destroy the parish and therefore weaken the influence of his church in society. And that's the problem that the entire hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church had in the 1950s and 60s, and which led to the Cultural Revolution, the Sex Revolution, because it simply couldn't have had it, with the demographics that existed prior to the 1960s. And suburbia was a big part of it. We talked about this in an earlier conversation I was on your show. We talked about it. But yeah, they don't understand psychological warfare or covert psychological warfare and social engineering, which is all around us.
Yeah. And when you try to explain it to them, when they're normally what the excuse is or the retort is when you're like, look, these people want you destroyed. A lot of them just fall back on, well, we're the more moral ones. You know, it's like our morality is going to win out.
How's it more moral if that lets evil prevail?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. I don't, you know, it used to, I mean, I used to be one of those people who was, who believe that you're basically morality was all that mattered. And morality means nothing when you're just, you know, when I was leaving libertarianism and I was trying to drag people out with me and people are just making all these moral arguments. And I'm like, you're going to be the most moral person on the boxcar. You know, so, I mean, what is that going to get you?
Yeah, you made that point about your friend who claimed that transgenderism just won out because of the marketplace of ideas. It's such a good idea, right? What? Anyway, explain to me Dylan Mulvaney on the cover on Bud Light Can.
Yeah, and they like the another conservative you know, right wing, quote unquote, right wing trope is, you know, go woke, go broke. Oh, they're going to go. That's not happening. It's not happening at all. You don't understand the dynamic. You don't understand what's happening.
Well, they don't understand things like BlackRock and ESG, Larry Fink, and how the banking system, how capital is apportioned and determined who gets it, who doesn't get it, right? It's that they create the money, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, BlackRock, despite Bud Light losing $6 billion, their ESG score goes way up when they get more funding to carry out social change. That's right. What ESG is.
Yeah. They just don't get it. We won World War II. We won World War II. We're the good guys. As long as we hang our hat on the fact that we're the good guys, a lot of them, I believe if you go into the military, at least some people have to take an oath that they will protect the country from enemies, foreign and domestic. It's so easy for people to recognize, you know, the enemy foreign. Well, it's not easy for them. You know, our greatest enemy they think is our greatest ally. Mm-hmm. But it's impossible for them to spot the enemy domestic, even though they think they know exactly who it is. They think they know exactly who it is. It's those Democrats. It's always the Democrats. They have no. If you were to say, well, okay, well, who's pulling the Democrat strings? No, this is Nancy Pelosi, and this is, okay. It's impossible. It's impossible to talk to them. And then, you know, we go back to libertarianism. They just think it's the state. You know, the problem is that people have power, and people have the ability to have power. And if we can just destroy power, if we can destroy the means by which they have power, then, you know, everything will be fine. You know, and, you know, if the state collapses, obviously everybody's going to adopt our ideology. The more I read, the more I research and I read authors who were right-wing authors who were writing after World War II, the more I realize that basically most of the people walking around nowadays are just completely oblivious to reality. They're just not living in reality. And I don't know what the cure is, other than, you know, the cure I always talk about is, you know, try to do things locally, try to fortify yourself locally.
You had you were recently had Millennial Woes,
yeah,
on your show,
yeah,
in that interview, and there in that interview you talked about weaponized migration in Great Britain. He talked about what was going on there, and he had some interesting observations, and he made a point about in the 1930s, the typical person at, say, Oxford University, even if they were liberal, would be a rabid right winger today. By today's standards, today's conventions. But at that time, he said, he, this is the difference between right and left, perhaps, is that he would entertain or hire someone who had radical politics or leftist politics if the person was mastered the subject, meaning his politics didn't matter as long as he mastered the subject. And he would tolerate his views with in the comfort thinking that he'd eventually grow out of these views, meaning they'll grow up, you know, basically, you know, if you're not a liberal before you're 30, you have no heart. If you're liberal after you're 30, you have no brain, as the saying goes. And that was sort of the assumption, sort of the cope of so many on the right, that people grow out of these things. And he said, well, that isn't true, meaning that what these many of these people were very serious. They meant what they say about tearing down society, carrying out a revolution, making war on its institutions and weaponizing institutions, and they're not going to grow out of it. And that's what's happened in the West. And we saw that in the past, you know, since the 19, well, yes, with the United States, you have sort of the cultural Marxist, the Frankfurt School, who at the same time that the university system was expanding rapidly in the 1950s and 60s, they were filling the slots. And typical ethnic networking of these Jews, they'd go in and take these slots and get in the school, and they implement these programs. And the conservatives that controlled the school at the time didn't, or they were naive or didn't have the will to shut them down or control it, with that idea that, again, these ideas didn't matter because they promised to support the system and the ideas behind it, but they didn't know they'd go and subvert these systems, as the universities evidently have for the most part in the West, particularly in the United States. But the idea is that once they're in power, they're not going to exercise the same tolerance for someone who's of the right or conservative who knows the subject, you're right, despite his politics. They won't hire them at all. And this speaks to that, again, they don't, the same tolerance isn't granted, the same courtesy isn't granted to the other side, because these people understand the reality of power. They mean what they say, and they intend to destroy civilization. Now, ultimately, I think oligarchs are controlling these crackpots, because oligarchs want a sort of an atomized, weakened society, no middle class, and these things, high low against the middle, bio-Leninism that we're seeing. That's what Bud Light and all that stuff is about. But I thought that was an interesting observation. I mean, they actually mean it. And this is you also did an interview with Aaron McIntyre about repressive tolerance, and Herbert Marcuse, another, you know, person of the same ethnic group, who, again, in his idea is you simply don't extend the courtesy of tolerance to your opponents. They make the friend enemy distinction. They have no problem making that distinction. They mean to impose it. In that situation, there's no such thing as a loyal opposition. They don't play by the same rules, and you can't deal with these people. You know, you can't give them these rights and these privileges because they don't believe in the same rules. They have a different worldview, which goes back to that old system of the Anxin regime, where you have an integral or confessional state of one degree or another, where some people are simply excluded from the political community or aren't given the privileges of leadership. Or the trustee, they're not entrusted with power over the society because they will use it to subvert it and destroy it, as they have. So,
yeah, the repressive tolerance essay I did with my friend Aaron, it's frustrating reading something like that, because what I've learned from reading Marxists over the years is that a lot of them make really good points. A lot of them, the diagnosis of what's wrong is usually pretty spot on. Even Hans Hermann Hoppe, the one libertarian writer that I think people can benefit a lot from, he said that he believed that Marx got about probably 90% right. And reading Repressive Tolerance, you start to realize that there, I guess he would be considered new left at the time, what would have been termed the new left. Their idea was, look, this, we understand we're going to be tolerant of our own, and we're going to suppress the people who are against us, the people who, basically people who want normalcy. They want radical freedom, individual freedom, and they're speaking the same language that, you know, conservatives and libertarians would talk about, but they're willing to suppress those who would go against them and oppress those who would go against them. And that's exactly what you see now. You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of the social engineers and a lot of the people, basically running things now use a lot of the language of individualism. And yeah, they do, but they very much like Marcuse, would, you know, say, well, yeah, sure, you know, people should have individual liberty to do, you know, to do what they want, to pursue their, you know, to pursue their happiness, as long as they agree with us. And I mean, it's kind of hard if you are somebody who recognizes exactly where we are as a society to not look at that and go, I agree in the opposite direction. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I want individual liberty for the people who agree with me and share my values, but I would like to suppress as much as possible the people who don't. The only problem is those are the people who are in charge right now.
And they got in charge by invoking liberal principles, liberal ideas. Right. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's like Dr. Gottfried said on my show in his recent article, Marx Was Not Woke, that the only way that he sees this regime being defeated is by a right-wing authoritarian movement.
Because liberal systems or principles can't be invoked against them.
No.
And that's language itself, like, good example is that Tucker comment, right, on this. Right.
Well, yeah. the James Lindsay, James Lindsay's responses to what Dr. Gottfried was saying, where he was responding to someone else, but he said, you know, the only way that we get through this is, he says, I'll read the tweet. Is Lauren Chen said, wokeism is Marxism, but it has arisen out of the failure of liberalism, in that liberalism has been powerless and totally incapable of stopping it. And James Lindsay, somebody who right wingers, you know, even people that probably, you know, listen to our shows will be like, hey, he's on our side. You know, he's a little, you know, he calls out the woke. And everything, he says, nothing but liberalism can stop woke. So I don't understand comments like this. Conservatism certainly hasn't done a damn thing and can't. He says, rule of impartial law will have to do it. Subverted liberalism hasn't been using that. Liberalism hasn't even started yet. So literally, James Lindsay, this hero of the right, because, you know, the right needs heroes. You know, anyone on the left who says anything nice about, you know, says anything derogatory towards your perceived enemy. Oh, this person, we have to, you know, bring the Weinsteins over. They're not going to subvert us at all. I mean, this guy is basically saying that, you know, liberalism has never been tried. I mean, it's like he's like a communist or a libertarian.
Yeah, like in 1988 or 89, saying, well, actually, it never was implemented.
Yeah, I mean, this is just...
Because it can't. Well, okay.
Yeah, and he says the rule of impartial law. And these are all... he's like... I don't know what these people are talking about. I do know what they're talking about. I don't understand why. It's like, how is this person like your friend? How is this person a quote unquote ally if they're telling you that liberalism, I mean, and this is a guy who has clearly said in the past, he is way more scared of a right-wing movement, right-wing, what he called fascist movement rising up than he is of the woke, of the woke.
Yeah. Interesting. And that is, that's betrayed in the fact that he actually makes a distinction between conservatism and liberalism, and conservatism is just liberal.
Yeah.
Just a form of liberal ideology. It's just a branch of it.
Yeah.
Controlled right wing. You know, it was created after World War II in America by the regime to prevent real opposition to the Nuremberg regime, if you will, the Cold War and these things. And because they didn't want anything like America First, which was real opposition in the 1930s and 40s to the regime forming. So they created, you know, Wim Hof Buckley and the post-war conservative movement, you know.
Yeah.
which didn't challenge the precepts of the Nuremberg regime.
Yeah, when people are arguing for liberalism and liberal, liberal tenets, they don't even realize what they're doing. They're basically arguing for their own slavery. You can talk about that. I mean, in the whole argument of, well, is the woke thing, is it Marxism? Is it liberalism? What is it? Really, the only thing that matters to me in that whole argument is when this does get destroyed, when what is in power now is no longer in power, what do we do next? What comes next? Because it's not going to be Marxist. Americans, people who've grown up in this, are not going to accept Marxism. Okay. But they will accept liberalism. They will accept live and let live again. It's like, oh, we got rid of our oppressors. Let's go back to live and let live. Let's go back to, how's that going to work? I mean, is it all of a sudden not going to be a multicultural society? Is it not all of a sudden going to be, millions and millions of illegals side by side? Is it all of a sudden not going to be all of these corporate cronies and all of this collusion? Is it going to be laissez-faire economics? It's hard to think about what comes next when you see exactly what's happening now and you're suffering under this. But really, somebody has to think about that. Somebody has to think about what comes next.
Yeah, I mean, John Adams, okay, founding father, second U.S. president of the United States.
Yes.
If I have that right.
Yep. Second U.S. president, first one-term president.
Yes. He said that our Constitution, our system of government cannot exist outside in the absence of a moral people. And so if you have all those in power promoting immorality and internal chaos in the guise of liberalism or liberty and these things, the system doesn't work and it's not working. If you have a moral people, that presumes that a certain morality is being imposed. There's a certain degree of prescription that's imposed. People are told how to behave and in many respects told what to think. And people need a certain degree of prescription. Like I said, not everyone, most people are not moral philosophers. Their morality is determined by custom. And so you could say that the ideal of liberalism can only be, or at least the idea of liberalism can only be entertained sort of out there in the ether somewhere through semi-authoritarian measures. It's an apparent contradiction, if you will, because there has to be a certain degree of shall nots in society, and appeals to individualism and freedom. These are dangerous ideas. They undermine, again, it's a question, if you promote any willy-nilly crazy idea and tolerate it. Toleration, that's a funny word, isn't it? Because it's not really a positive word. It's not, you say to your wife, I tolerate you. Oh, that's nice, honey, right? We tolerate things that are unpleasant, right? But we also know that thing, tolerance is also dangerous. Like if you have a high tolerance for alcohol, you're probably an alcoholic and you're killing yourself. If you have low tolerance and you drink alcohol, you vomit, you're protecting yourself. So a society that's highly tolerant is very diseased and sick. It's a society that's low tolerance that is strong because it has a good immune system, if you will, or a defense against bad poisons and bad ideas. And that's the problem. So they've preached tolerance, for all the bad ideas and, to support revolution, but they impose an authoritarian system to prevent counter-revolution. And we see that, with the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center, today's Latter-day Sanhedrin, that impose all these speech codes, hate speech, and penalties for challenging their power, their worldview. So at the very least, it's very obvious that those who claim to be liberals don't even follow their own precepts or idea or principles. It's obvious, you know, because the moment they're confronted with ideas or speech which they can't contend with, the iron fist comes out, you know, and swats you down in one degree or another, you know.
Yeah, well, and
but then I can be embarrassed by their hypocrisy. That's another thing. It's a waste to point that out.
Yeah, I mean, pointing out the hypocrisy of people who don't care, who all they care about is power, and you know, it's not all they care about. I mean, they desire power so that they can get their vision of the world. Their vision of the world just turns out to be completely. Complete chaos.
Yeah.
And you never hear another thing you never hear right wingers talk about. You never hear them talk about order. You never hear them talk about what order. You know, I shouldn't say right wingers because that's a very broad term. I know there are people who are listening who are really good right wingers, but there are some just conservatives.
Yeah.
They have no idea. Do you desire order? Sure. All right. What's it going to take? What's it going to take? What would it take? I mean, was Kenosha order when Kyle Rittenhouse, when a 17-year-old kid was out there trying to stop people from setting fires and burning the city down, which it was already in the process of doing? Was that order? Was Minneapolis order starting the last week of May 2020? You know, what does it take what is it going to take for us to have order? And really, basically, the only way you can have order is you have to crush the people who are, you know, causing the disorder, causing the chaos. And unfortunately, though, those people are backed up by people in the most powerful offices in the land. People with more money than right wingers are willing to people on the right conservatives or are willing to how do all of these psychotic groups have bail funds already to bail them out, yet when groups that really aren't even right wing, like the Proud Boys, get in jail, there's no like set fund, there's no elites ready to bail them out. The right has the conservatives and even a lot of people on the right, the real right, haven't figured out yet that we need our own elites. This doesn't happen without elites. And where do you go if you have no elites and they have a lot of elites? And I think they have like too many elites. There's a watering down of elites, but still, you know, they're in power and you're not. And while, you know, a lot of the people listening to this want to see their friends in power or people who are, sympathetic to their values in power, they're not in power right now. Well, how do you get them in power? I mean, let's start with the basics. Let's start with the basics. And it's not going, you know, following liberal ideas of live and let live and, the marketplace of ideas. That's not helping. We should be thinking about other means now, and definitely looking at the means that, you know, your enemy uses to basically lord it over you.
Yeah, they do it under the cover of law, right? They have they have the power of the state behind them.
Yep.
And absolutely. It's if you look at sort of the an outfit like the FBI, which has always been problematic and corrupt, and engaged in agent provocateur activity that dates back, you know, even to the 1930s and 40s. Of course, a lot of people know about the activities in the 60s with COINTELPRO and how they radicalized the Black Panthers. And even up to now, January 6th, and of course, the the case out in Michigan with the kidnapping plot, and we did a show on, of course, on the Oklahoma City bombing and PatCon and what that suggests. But there was a time when the FBI, at least they gave lip service to the Constitution, and there's a degree of professionalism. It hired a lot of Catholic men, you know, to fill the ranks of the agents. And there was a sense of probity, at least an image that had to be maintained. Now they're hiring pink-haired degenerates, you know, lesbians, radicals. I read an article. There's an article I read in Culture Wars about the trial of Mark Houck in Pennsylvania. As a classic example of the FBI pretty much being used like the Cheka, a counter-revolutionary force. And why? And of course, this caught the attention of Senator Josh Hawley when he was grilling a U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland about this ridiculous case where they sent 20, heavily armed agents to arrest this guy for a misdemeanor assault case that took place a couple of years ago outside an abortion clinic in Philadelphia, a case which the local prosecutor didn't even deem fit to press charges. I think the man who was allegedly assaulted didn't even show up for the civil trial. But nevertheless, Merrick Garland thought it appropriate to send more than 20 agents in SWAT get up to pull him out of his house and terrorize his family. And this guy was simply guilty of praying outside an abortion clinic. He's a Catholic pro-life activist. And Josh Hawley is there with Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland, he asked Josh Hawley, do you have anything against Catholics? And Merrick Garland denies that, but justifies the raid. Mark Houck was acquitted, I think, after a couple of days. I think the jury deliberated for less than an hour. Shows the weakness of the Justice Department's case against him. But it was actually a malicious prosecution that really warrants an investigation. If Congress really was exercising oversight, heads would roll over this. But I read the article about the case, about the trial, and the author of the article was commenting on the demeanor and appearance of the FBI agents and the prosecuting team. And one of it was women in pantsuits. And he was talking about these these deranged single women, professional FBI agents and the lawyer, how they weren't prosecuting Mark Houck, but these are women that adamantly believe in abortion, legal abortion. And they're feminist, and they're obviously probably had abortion themselves. He was getting psychological. It's like that's why they're prosecuting this case. That it made no sense. And they're irrational. Their witnesses didn't make any sense, but they didn't care. They were going to prosecute this case. They didn't like Mark Houck because if you look at a picture of Mark Houck, he has 7 kids. I think 4 boys and 3 girls, and the 3 girls are wearing dresses, and the boys are wearing slacks. They're a happy, healthy family. That's what Merrick Garland, that's what these women, these deranged women that with the FBI and the Justice Department have against Mark Houck. It goes back to the authoritarian personality, meaning their enemy is this, it's that family, that healthy family, because that is according to the authoritarian personality, and to a certain degree they're not wrong, it is the germ seed of what they call fascism, which is authoritarianism, which is authority, which is hierarchy, which is order. It's normalcy, it's healthy. Everything that's healthy, they pathologize. Everything that's healthy is an enemy to them. And that's where we are. So anyone who's out there halfway normal is the enemy. So more than half the American public is the enemy to the regime.
And they've let them know it. And I mean, how have they responded? We just need to vote for Trump in 2024. We just need to vote for DeSantis in 2024. Mm-hmm. He'll fix everything. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think the conflict is ethnic in this case. And liberalism doesn't deal with ethnicity, as you saw there with the Tucker Carlson's.
Yeah, remarks. Yeah. I put out a tweet earlier that some people are losing their minds over. I said, I have no problem if people claim certain breeds of dogs are prone to being violent by their nature, as long as they apply the same metric to certain races of humans.
Well, as we can see in Chicago.
I mean, well, yeah. I mean, but that's all socioeconomics.
Did you, this is funny. I got to read this to you. Yeah, here we go. Pete Buttigieg, our illustrious Secretary of Transportation and homosexual father of two, which he fathered apparently with another man. He adopted, actually. He basically, it's child trafficking. He bought these two babies. But he came out and said that minorities dying in car crashes due to their race. He says it's a much higher rate of traffic fatality and pedestrian fatalities among people of color, and this is because the roads are racist. It has nothing to do with their driving habits or how they don't follow, you know, the crosswalks. They walk diagonally across a busy road, which I see all the time. But only this is racism. We have to be concerned with. So, it might not be because they're not behaving, following the traffic laws, speeding, driving erratically, something I observe day to day, every day when I'm driving around.
Yeah,
but well, it's racism. It's, yeah, any disparity is racism.
What does Steve Saylor call that? Deaths of exuberance or something like that.
They did the thing. There's a recent study came out that apparently a black teenager are 9 times more likely to be arrested than white teenagers. Now, why is that? Could it be because the cops are racist, or maybe one group engages in criminal activity far more than the other? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I've looked at the race statistics, and when it comes to violent crime, I think I know what group is, per capita way ahead of everyone else.
But then the mayor of Chicago, or soon to be mayor, I think he's set to take office in May, Brandon Johnson, said that we shouldn't demonize the exuberant teens that rioted last weekend in Chicago because they're acting out on frustration and poverty and hunger. Apparently they were hungry. That's why they were like bashing in car windows. And
I actually, there was not very far from where I live. There was a party or a wedding reception or something.
Oh, yes. That's in
Dadeville, Alabama. And you heard about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a guy who makes videos on YouTube where he goes to small towns in Alabama, and he tours them, says, whether they seem nice, looks at the statistics and everything. Well, his response to this video, his response to this shooting was to do a video where he basically blamed the history of racism by white people in Alabama for this crime. Now, this is a mestizo Mexican who looks like a friggin' monkey. And he's just, you're listening to this, and I'm listening to it. My wife, and my wife is a lot more normie than I am. And she's just like, what the hell is this guy talking about? So how can they, and this is, then you go into the comments and people, I'm embarrassed to be from Alabama. Everything. It's like, the town of Dadeville is 45% black. And then he mentions Birmingham and all the violence. I'm like, Birmingham is 65% black. And then every town he mentioned was like 40, a black population over 45%. But he made clear, he said, anyone who comments about the racial demographics in any town I mentioned, I'm going to, delete those comments. This is exactly like what, this is how we live. These are the people who are around us who think like this. And until people realize that you are not going to logic your way into a, winning an argument with somebody like this.
No.
These are people that just need to be suppressed.
Especially if they're in a mob.
Yeah. These are people, and yes, some people need to be handled. And you just can't. I don't know how people have gotten to the point where, you know, I believe that, like, I said this recently, I can't remember what podcast I was on. I said, yeah, I believe people are basically born under in nature and having a good understanding of nature. And I think, you know, really being a lot of being right wing is, you know, accepting the natural order and how and hierarchy and how everything works. Mm-hmm. I don't believe people are just born like right wing authoritarians, like phalangists or national socialists. I believe they're made that way. And so I'm sorry, but I mean, I just don't know how, when you survey what this culture has become, that anyone on the right can be surprised when people are like, hey, it's gonna take a lot to destroy these people.
Well, remember the trope or the idea that the children learn racism from their parents?
Yeah.
And reality is that children learn racism from observing, like white kids observing dealing with black kids. And that's just the reality. And it's ugly. It's just the truth. It's not pleasant. It's just the truth, the way they behave. That's just the reality of the situation. There was a study in Boston. I think Boston's 27% black. And apparently blacks are responsible for virtually all the shootings and murders in the city. You know, and you know, Boston, I always thought was kind of a rough town, like the Irish up there and a fair amount of crime, but that shocked me. But I was saying, whoa. But that's, see, the racial narrative. People look, that's another thing that's different is in the past, people would come to the country and there'd be a sense that here they're coming in smaller numbers. So they come, they're going to assimilate and they're going to own, they're going to accept some sort of responsibility or gratitude towards the country. They come in such large numbers, they don't assimilate. At the same time, they're indoctrinated with critical race theory to hate the country and absolutely adopt the victim mentality, right? That narrative.
Absolutely. When my dad's family came here, you know, there's a reason why my first name is Anglo. There's a reason why I never learned how to speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Because my dad and his family was like, well, we're Americans now, and we are going to act like Americans.
And there was a dominant Anglo-American culture that said, you must, right?
Yeah.
This is our country, and that works. Here's a case. I remember a couple of years ago, I forget what restaurant it was. It was in Minneapolis. This was before the George Floyd nonsense. But there is a... basically, the restaurant is you come in, you order the food, you go down the line, and you pay when you get to the end of the line.
Yeah.
And it was on videotape, and this gang of black kids come in, and they start ordering, and they say, we're not going to serve you. And they say, why? Why? And the lady running is an Hispanic lady. She goes, because he's doing it. And she's this 50-ish guy in his mid-50s. White guy and paying. He says, well, you let him do it. He says, well, he pays and you don't. And he goes, man. And the guy, and by the way, these kids are like second generation Somalis.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So they were brought to this country, and all of a sudden they're this marauding gang. And he says, hey, man, that's racism. So he knows the score, the script, if you will. So he knows the con. That's racism. That's racism. It went viral on, I guess it was TikTok or something, YouTube, and so this is racism, and the company immediately fired the manager.
Of course.
A day later, it comes out that this individual, this gang, had posted on social media, whether it's Facebook, it might have been Facebook at the time, they do this dine and ditch thing, bragging about how all the restaurants they've ripped off in the area doing that. So she was right. She knew the score. She had street smarts, you know. But that's it. But here, this immigrant, community come here. All of a sudden, they know to play up the racism angle. The same way that what's that representative from Minneapolis, the Muslim chick from
Ilhan Omar.
Yeah. She the racism stuff. She comes here condemning the country and all that. You know where she illegally got into the country through illegal immigration, lying. I think marrying her brother or something, right?
Yeah. And then they made they allowed Somalis to become police, and that a Somali cop shot that Australian, the white Australian woman, a couple of years ago. You remember that?
Yeah, because we're all equal, right?
Right.
That's sort of the religion, that egalitarianism. It's, and then equity, and everything has to be equally. Any disparity is racism. You have to get rid of all disparities, no matter how much it costs in terms of competence or, you know, expertise. And so pretty soon you have the bridges falling and planes not taking off because you have to have equity, and the power grid fails. when the lights go out, right? Well, at least we're equal.
Well, yeah. I mean, at least we weren't racist. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, that'll be, yeah, that's, you know, you can put it on your gravestone. At least no one ever called me racist, or as you're being shoved into the pit, you know, with your bullet in the back. Don't, please don't call me racist. It's a checker shoots you in the back of the skull. At least I'm not racist.
I think that's what conservatives are way more concerned about, being labeled a racist than they are about, you know, losing their country.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you had that spectacle in Chicago at Millennium Park. I think in that you had a white woman that was assaulted by a gang of, you know, black teenagers, and no one's comment. The media isn't covering it. No one's talking about it. And that's what it was. You saw the media reports. A group of teens, marauding teens, and I saw the video, and it says, yeah, the first thing I noticed about the crowd is they're all teenagers. That's the first thing I noticed. That's the one commonality that I immediately recognized, is they're all teenagers. How do you know they're all teens, by the way?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what you want. You want people, you know, running through neighborhoods who have low impulse control. That makes complete sense.
Bad parenting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's it. It probably has nothing to do with genetics either. So,
well, Pete, I cheated a little bit. Said I have you on for an hour.
It's all right, Tim.
Time got away from me.
I always love talking to you.
So, well, listen. So, Pete, thanks so much for coming back on the show. And anything you want to promote?
Sure. Anytime. Thank you for inviting me. The Pete Quinones Show, all podcatchers. Not on YouTube anymore. Odyssey, BitChute, and Rumble, and PeteSubstack.com.
So, okay, thanks so much, Pete.
All right, thanks a lot, Tim. Appreciate it.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
Chance to win. Leaves start falling, come down is calling, loneliness starts sinking in. But I'm one, I'm one, and I can see that this is me, and I will be. You'll all see I'm the one. Where do you get those blue jeans? Faded, packed secrets so tight. Where do you get that walk of so lean? It's all just right. I'm one, I am one, and I can see that this is me, and I will be. You'll all see I'm the one. I got a Gibson without a case, but I can't get that even tanned look on my face. Ill-fitting clothes, and I blend in the crowd. Fingers so clumsy, voice too loud. But I'm